Ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for being here this evening. I bring greetings from the Vice Chancellor, who is away on university business. Would very much like to have been here. My name is Crane Sodine, and I'll be chairing the proceedings this evening. I'm a Deputy Vice Chancellor at the university. So, allow me to, first of all, warmly welcome Dr. Earl Lewis and Susan Whitlock. Thank you, Susan. Dr. Lewis's partner. And also a warm welcome to Stuart Saunders, former Vice Chancellor, and to all of you. Very honoured to have Dr. L. Lewis address us this evening. I'm going to say a little bit about him in a moment, but I'd first of all like to say, first of all, whom he represents. Dr. Lewis is the newly installed president of the Andrew Millen Foundation, and he was installed in March this year. Very pleased to have you here, sir. The Millen Foundation, as most of you know, is one of the most important philanthropic organizations in the United States, with a proven commitment to advancing higher education, the arts, and civil society. We've had an association with the Millen Foundation which goes back to 1988. We're extremely grateful for that. The Millen Foundation has supported almost 600, since then, UCT fellows. Its main goal is to develop, in South Africa that is, its main goal is to develop capacity by providing opportunities for individuals who were previously disadvantaged, and individuals have demonstrated a commitment to the previously disadvantaged. There are currently 45 million awardees at UCT at the moment. In announcing Dr. Lewis's election to head the foundation, Millen's board cited his, and I'm quoting now, strategic thinking, ability to focus on the critical issues relating to the humanities, as well as his broad experience as a teacher, scholar, and leader at major public and private research universities over more than two decades. Close quotes. Dr. Lewis's experience is far and wide. From July 2004 to March 2013, he was the provost, that is for South Africans, not accustomed to that terminology, the chief academic officer and executive vice president for academic affairs at Emory University, one of the world's leading research universities, probably the leading research university in the South. Dr. Lewis is also the Asa Griggs Candler Professor of History and African American Studies at Emory. His colleagues at Emory praised Dr. Lewis for his performance as a visionary administrator, generous mentor, a dynamic educator, who made a lasting impact, and listen to this, as the university's chief academic officer and a wicked basketball player and loyal memory of Emory's own NBA, the Noontime Basketball Association, made up of anyone who showed up for a pickup game. At Emory, Dr. Lewis created the Office of Community and Diversity, an effort to sustain and develop Emory's ability to value diversity. He instilled in Emory the conviction, and I'm quoting again, the best part of community is diversity. He's an historian who holds a BA from Concordia College, a master's and PhD from the University of Minnesota, and has established himself as a leading scholar in the field of African American studies and is well known for his leadership in higher education. Prior to joining Emory in 2004, he held faculty appointments at the University of Michigan, University of California at Berkeley. At Michigan, he was also vice provost and dean of the Horace H. Rackham School of Graduate Studies. Since the publication of his monograph, it's called In Their Own Interests, Race, Class, and Power in 20th Century Norfolk, He has co-authored or co-edited 6 books dealing with the contemporary history and social status of African Americans. These include co-authorship of the widely acclaimed Love on Trial, An American Scandal in Black and White with Heidi Ardizzone, and the historically vital Defending Diversity Affirmative Action at the University of Michigan. Dr. Lewis will talk to us tonight, and I'm very proud that he's able to be with us here at the beginning of his tenure at Millen. Will talk to us about the debates around exactly that issue, where the debate is going in higher education in the United States. Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis.
The audience is easy, it's the microphone is difficult, and I realize. Thank you for that very, very warm introduction. I was on campus today and had an opportunity to spend quite a few hours talking to faculty and colleagues from various departments and programs on the UCT campus, and was recalling with Stuart the very first time I came to this campus was 1991. And so this is my 5th trip to South Africa, a 4th trip since that time, so 5 trips in all. But it's still incredible to think about the intervening 25 years when I first conceived of coming here, and certainly the last 22, now going on 23 years. And I'm reminded of the ways in which location and history play a role in shaping the moment. And so what I wanted to do today was to spend a little time really thinking about and talking about the affirmative action contours in the U.S. And first, let me acknowledge Max. I know he wanted to be here, and he realized when we considered this opportunity, he was going to be in Nigeria. And then I thought about the appropriateness of having me give a chancellor's lecture when he was somewhere else, vice chancellor's lecture when he was somewhere else. And I assured him if he was okay with it, I would be okay with it. And I understand there will be a taping, and so he'll have to look at it in the conventional way of today's world, in his own form of YouTube. And so a university version. When Max and I were in my offices in New York, we were talking about, really, in a really deep and reflective way, the history of race and opportunity, the ways in which we think about equity in our respective countries. And as we talked across the table from one another, we realized that it was possible for me while I was here to first start in a monologue, and hopefully that monologue could quickly turn into a dialogue. And so what I hope to do is to go over some major themes in a short period of time and then open it up so that we actually get to have an opportunity for a dialogue. Now, the topic of affirmative action is rather large, spanning economics and politics, sociology, criminology, education, housing, and a wide range of other topics. And in the United States, after 2.5 centuries of slavery and another century of segregation, the policy remains anything but settled. Think about it. When we talked about the idea of what it means to actually maximize opportunity across the fault lines of race in hopes of achieving equity as well as equality, the first time around, it was still an analog world. What do I mean? That in some ways, to understand it required you to be in that place and to experience it in real time. But we've entered the digital world and the digital era. And in the United States, and public policies and laws have really not caught up with this change, let alone the reasoning that undergirds the interpretations and policies. Race, as we know, has no geographic boundary in today's world. And social policy in the United States has implications for citizens well beyond its boundaries. An example, in fact, of the change in the digital era is the flow of information, which moves around the world in seconds. So while here, I have anxiously consulted my many electronic devices, knowing that in any day now, the United States Supreme Court will decide the Fisher case, the latest chapter in a legal battle over affirmative action in the United States. And no matter the finer points of that decision, many of us in the United States sense that its rendering will have transnational implications, because it would be yet another step in a chapter about how the U.S., one of the most powerful nations in the world, talks about and understands the questions of race, equity, and equality. And for those of us who have supported diversity and a democratic society, and particularly the idea of advancing a diverse democracy by distinguishing between equality and equity, we also know that the Fisher case then will force us to yet one more time try to understand how do we put structures of opportunity in place to ensure that we can tap the greatest talent in the most diverse sense of the nation. Now, many of you may not know the Fisher case, so let me start there as a way to then go back into history and bring us full circle over the course of the time I want to speak. The Fisher case actually grows out of the University of Texas in Austin. And Texas has a particular demographic profile. And so 10% plan was created at the University of Texas. And so in the state of Texas in the United States, any student who graduates in the top 10% of his or her high school has guaranteed admission to the University of Texas, which is a public institution. Okay. In addition, if you have a certain academic profile, you went to a high-achieving high school or academic institution in Texas, and you fell just below the 10% cutoff, but you still have an academic profile suggesting admission, you are admitted to the University of Texas. And then thirdly, they had something they call the personal index, where they were trying to make sure they tapped a wide range of talent in the state of Texas. They needed flute players for the band. And so they would make sure they were able to identify the top player in Texas, irrespective of where he or she may live. And for those of you who know anything about the United States and our quaint game called football, which is the American version of football and not the international version of football, the University of Texas needed football players. They also needed then this personal index to allow them to identify football players who were not in the top 10% and didn't have the otherwise academic profile. And so they came up with this particular set of indexes. So there were essentially three ways for gaining admission to the University of Texas. A group of students filed suit, alleging that they had been denied admission because they were not admitted through the 10% plan. They were not admitted through the academic index option, nor were they admitted through the personal index option. And they concluded the only reason they weren't admitted is because that the personal index option included among the various variables race. That their likelihood of gaining admission to the University of Texas, they argued, would have been enhanced had there not been the race element to the personal index. Now, I would argue the statistics actually don't support that. But to everyone's surprise, after the U.S. appellate court decided that the University of Texas was legal, that is, in 2002-2003, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case coming out of the University of Michigan, Grutter, that race could be one of several variables in an admissions process in public institutions in the United States. The U.S. appellate courts concluded that indeed the University of Texas had met the Grutter standard. They were using race not as a single variable, but as one of several variables for admission. And to everyone's surprise, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to take on the case nonetheless. Now, in 2002-03, the U.S. Supreme Court had argued, and with Sandra Day O'Connor, who's since retired from the court, has said that this provision for the use of race as one of several variables will no doubt be part of U.S. social policy for at least another 25 years. And she was hoping that, maybe after 25 years it could be revisited. But she opened at least another 25 years. We were 9 years later. when the court decided to take on this case. And so that is why I've been checking my phone, because it was suggested that this next chapter would either occur, and we would know the results of that next chapter either Monday in the U.S. or this coming Thursday. And so I alert you to what we may find. Well, why do we find ourselves at this moment with the larger, this sort of question of why do we think about affirmative action in the United States, especially as it regards higher education? Well, let me start with the past, and let me start with a little story. In 2006, I had the great pleasure of meeting a woman named Lucille Clifton. She was visiting Emory University, where I then served as provost. Lucille was a distinguished poet. And her visit happened to come just a few weeks after the death of my own mother. And Lucille, who had been born in DuPont, New York, near Buffalo, did a wonderful job of listening to me go on about the woman who had given me birth, who raised my younger brother and me after the premature death of our father and her husband. And Lucille went on to tell me about herself, that her family had Virginia roots. And she suggested poems for me to read and ways for me to reconcile the evolution of life from birth to death that is part of the natural cycle. Lucille herself would die in February of 2010, almost 4 years to the day of my mother's death. Now, you're probably asking me, what does Lucille Clifton, a celebrated poet, have to do with today's address? Well, in words and actions, she revealed the beauty of the human imagination and served as continued proof that genius could be found in many places and come in many forms. Lucille grew up in a Polish neighborhood in Buffalo. As a result, she learned a few Polish words and became known in her community as the little colored Polish girl. When Lucille was born in 1936, the United States was struggling through the travails of a severe economic recession, which became known as the Great Depression. Segregation or Jim Crow prevailed de jure in the South and de facto in many other parts of the United States. Very few of America's leading universities would admit her as many other black students, so she, at the age of 16, went to Howard University. In the early 1950s, Howard represented the pinnacle of black intellectual life. Most of the nation's leading African-American intellectuals either taught at the Washington Institution or had taught there, or, as a colleague would say to me years later, had wanted to teach there. In the segregated world that was 1950s America, historically black colleges and universities such as Howard played an immensely important role. And a college degree represented options for those who got in beyond work as a day laborer or as a domestic. It offered kids such as Lucille the chance to dream that one day they could become poets, writers, scientists, and inventors. And true to form, many years after she had graduated from Howard, she would become a college professor, an award-winning poet, and as well a sharp and incisive observer of American life and culture. In the nearly half a century since Lucille headed off to Washington, D.C. into college, much in America changed. Most notably, the legal prohibitions on interracial relations. Nearly 60 years ago, May 17, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court tackled one of the most vexing issues in American life, the question of whether black and white kids should be allowed to attend the same schools. Now, since the end of the Civil War, local municipalities had effectively segregated all aspects of life. And when the Supreme Court ruled in 1896 in the Plessy decision, which established the principles of separate but equal, it also then really reaffirmed the idea that the Constitution could be leveraged to provide some with certain privileges and others with other rights and privileges. Then the Supreme Court would rule in 1954, and here's where Justice Earl Warren, the former governor of California, who had done many things in his life, among them in terms of Japanese Americans during World War II when he was governor of California, Justice Warren would write the opinion for the court. Now, this case came out of the states of Texas and South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware. And in the opinion that was delivered, and I'm reading here and quoting, in each of the cases, the minors of the Negro race, through their legal representatives, seek the aid of the courts in obtaining admission to the public schools of their community on a non-segregated basis. In each instance, they had been denied admission to schools attended by white children under laws requiring or permitting segregation according to race. This segregation was alleged to deprive the plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws under the 14th Amendment. The quote will go on. Today, education is perhaps the most important function of state and local governments. Compulsory school attendance laws and the great expenditures for education both demonstrate our recognition of the importance of education to our democratic society. It is required in the performance of our most basic public responsibilities, even service in the armed forces. It is the very foundation of good citizenship. Today, it is a principal instrument in awakening the child to cultural values and preparing him for later professional training and in helping to adjust normally to his environment. The quote would then continue, thus segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities. We believe it does, decides the court. And it would go on then, these members of the court would go on to talk about the importance of addressing separate but equal, and in effect, saying it was now null and void. For those of you who are students of American history, you realize this Brown decision, as it became known, there actually were two Brown decisions. There was the original one in 54, and there was a second one because the decision was remanded back to the lower courts and those jurisdictions for additional examination. And it's from that clause that came the most famous of sayings for at least an era, all deliberate speed. In the 55 decision, the courts instructed then the various states across the South to desegregate with all deliberate speed. Well, I was born in 1955. I was born in Virginia in 1955, and I would say I'm a product of all deliberate speed. So what does that mean? That schools, at least in my part of Virginia and much of the rest of the South, remained segregated until 1970. And so from 1955 to 1970, basically the schools remained segregated. It was 1970 and 71 where they began the real most effective chapter in desegregating schools in the South. All my classmates were black, and until I was in the eighth grade, so too were my teachers, except for Mrs. Estrada, a Filipina, who was deemed too colored to be allowed in the white schools. In the fall of 1971, my sophomore year, I entered the world of desegregation, and the school I attended broke down this way, 45% African-American, 55% white. It was in Chesapeake, Virginia. And there I gained a perspective on the Brown decision that I and most of my colleagues have failed to stress in the history books that we've written, but have implications for contemporary policy. Typically, this chapter is told as a case in the search for equality. But I actually think you can talk about it as not just for a search for equality, but also a way to begin to talk about how do you build a diverse democracy? How do we understand the elements that go into building a diverse democracy? After all, sitting next to me in my classes were the nephews and nieces of the Grand Dragons of the Ku Klux Klan. And we knew this because we talked about it and they acknowledged it. And so, I mean, there's a way in which there were competing visions of America. And they were in play on the schoolyards and then the various boardrooms and other parts. I mean, my 10th grade geometry teacher used to regale us with stories of the good old days on the plantation. Although this had nothing to do with geometry. One, and two, at least half of her class disagreed with her about the good old days. Now, I tell these stories for one simple purpose. education has been part of ground zero in the battle over whose vision of America would prevail. And it continues to be. And it forces us to ask, when we go back to the Brown decision, who were the intended beneficiaries? Who were to have benefited from the desegregation that flowed from the Brown decision? Black kids? White kids? Brown, yellow, and red kids, when we use the color schemes of America? I would say a quick read of the historical record and the accompanying social science data that supported the conclusions reached in Brown will lead you to believe that, without question, black kids were to have been the beneficiaries. Their systematic exclusion prompted the court to rule separate but equal was unconstitutional. Desegregated schooling was to be a benefit for black kids. And we see some results. One indicator is the percentage of students going to college and university after 1960. And in fact, if you look at the period between just 1983 and 2003, just that 20-year period alone, the high school completion rate for African Americans jumped from 68% to 76%, according to a report submitted by the American Council for Education. Since 1978, the college participation rate has grown from 11% to 14%. Now, all of this is to say that while the primary focus may have been on African Americans, we realize that that's not the only part of the story. One of the things that also occurred when you started looking at both college attendance and graduation rates is that something else was occurring in the United States at the same time. One was resegregation. And so in studies by Gary Orfield and Xingmei Li of the Civil Rights Project, formerly at Harvard University and now at UCLA, they've observed that districts that implemented court-mandated desegregation programs in the 1960s and 70s have abandoned such efforts with the approval of the court, even though the numbers show that schools are increasingly resegregated. And so one of the things, if you look at the data in the United States, more and more urban districts are more segregated now than they were in the late 50s and early 60s. It's one of the conundrums that we face as we think about how to create an active, if not an affirmative, social policy in the United States. Now, resegregation is less of a problem in small towns and rural areas and more substantial in metropolitan areas, but it's real. And except in the South and the Southwest, white students, who account for 60% of public school attendees, have little chance of interacting with black or brown kids by attending public schools. And if the most, and I'm quoting here, the study has found that the vast majority of intensely segregated minority schools face conditions of concentrated poverty, which are powerfully related to unequal educational opportunity. End quote. So the issue is not just segregation, but the unequal distribution of resources. These findings return us to the question of who was to have benefited from desegregation and integration. Harvard University Law School professor Lonnie Grenier has noted the Brown decision was silent on the benefit for whites. But if you go back to those cases leading up to Brown, the lawyers and their experts addressed this issue directly. In a case that became known as Sweat versus Painter, and they actually turned to then Penn Law School Dean Earl Harrison, who was cross-examined in the case by lawyers from the state of Texas. And around 1949, he says, quote, "A very important facility of a modern law school consists of one's classmates. In other words, it isn't enough to have a good professor. It is equally essential that there be a well-rounded, representative group of students in the classroom." And so even though Brown itself was silent, the body of law that was put into the record to build up to Brown talked about the mutual benefit of a diverse learning environment. And that was one of the core premises upon which Brown then rested as it moved through the course. The Brown decision, therefore, must be understood as part of the ongoing debate about the kind of America to be claimed by a number of its citizens. and African Americans through the auspices of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, directed the country to explore what it meant to extend the promise of democracy to all. And here is sometimes the role of higher education in establishing the legal precedents goes unacknowledged by contemporary commentators. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole range of the cases here, but it's important that as we think about Brown and move it forward to contemporary context, we realize that education, particularly higher education in the United States, was also about how one begins to build a democratic society. And the question of building a democratic society and building a diverse democratic society finds its way into a lot of the contemporary research on diversity in American higher education. I'll bring you to a case that I've both written about and I know something about in great depth. The University of Michigan was the scene then for the most important Supreme Court case, I would argue, on higher education or on education in the United States since the Brown decision. And why? The Brown decision was based on extraordinary social science and historical research. They brought together scholars from a wide range of fields to actually support the argument that segregated schools were harmful. University of Michigan, in the Grutter and Gratz cases, there were two cases, one at the undergraduate level, a second one at the law school level, replicated the intensity of that research for the contemporary era. It brought together social scientists, particularly psychologists and education experts, historians, sociologists, demographers, and all, to begin to look at the effects of education for advancing a diverse democratic society. And in research at the University of Michigan conducted by Pat Gurren and her colleagues, in conjunction with these Grutter and Gratz cases, you find evidence that underscores the point that educational diversity had learning and democracy outcomes for all students. Students who learn in diverse educational settings ask more questions in class, according to the research, learn to tolerate and even appreciate different perspectives, and tended to participate in a variety of social or civic organizations once they graduated. And so, pause here for a second, because what the research showed is that not only were they engaging in more thoughtful engagement in the classroom, but they actually then continue to do so by engaging in civic and social organizations with more regularity after they graduated. This was part of the argument that learning in a certain kind of environment enhanced democratic outcomes once students graduated. Now, it may have taken much longer for the elements of this engaged learning to take effect had it not been for the understanding, too, that it required intentional action on the part of the university. It was not just enough to have people sitting next to each other. You actually had to develop programs that actually required individuals to think in different ways, to interrogate the ideas that they held deeply, to actually imagine that what they learned inside of a university had application for the things that went on in the various communities that surrounded those universities. This is 1954 into 1970-71. In the U.S., this chapter of Brown and what Brown led up to is important to understand as one of the longest chapters. The all deliberate speed phase in American history lasted then for a good 16, 17 years. The shortest phase actually was the race affirmative action chapter in American history, race conscious affirmative action chapter in American history. If you think of it, it was actually only lasted from 1970-71 to 1978. Because in 1978, in the Supreme Court, in the Bakke decision, would give birth to the diversity argument. That we went from just talking about race and race awareness to the idea that race could be one of several variables, but it could not be the sole and lead variable. And so I, as an American historian, I keep saying that the shortest chapter in U.S. history is one where we actually acknowledge that there was something that pre-existed Brown. And in some ways, I've often said to my colleagues, we would be instructed to actually look both at the South African Constitution and the Indian Constitutions, where different questions are put on the table for consideration. I won't take you through the Bakke decision, but what Bakke did was to change the ways in which American higher education actually addressed opportunity by saying that you could no longer do what the University of California had tried to do. And so the University of California, Davis, has set aside 10 seats in its medical school for African Americans, although UC Davis and the University of California system had no history of systematically excluding African Americans. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Bakke decision that this amounted to a quota, and that a quota system in the United States was unconstitutional. Harry Blackman, who wrote the majority opinion, and we end up seeing then race could be one of several factors. It just could not be the predominant factor, and certainly couldn't be the only factor. So for the last 10 years, I have wondered, what happens when the diversity argument fails? What happens when the diversity argument fails in the United States? I mean, that's in part why I've been listening and waiting to see what the Supreme Court would decide in the Fisher case. Because in effect, the Fisher case has the potential of closing and narrowing the ways in which race and diversity can be used as a factor in admissions in the tertiary sector. There have been a number of scholars and critics who have gone on to say that in the U.S. it may be important for diversity, for the race-aware diversity argument to come up, to fail. And I say it's important in part because what we have not achieved is the democratic outcomes that Pat Byrne and her colleagues have actually demonstrated in their scholarship. Some have argued that one of the indicators is the self-segregation that you see on colleges and universities in the United States and the ways in which people socialize in those particular environments. I mean, I'll tell a little story. Circa 1992, 1993, I was the director of the Center for African American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. And 60 Minutes, the CBS television program, came to me. And they wanted to do a program on the ways in which kids self-segregated on the University of Michigan campus. And I spent a week with a producer trying to convince them they had actually asked the wrong question. And I finally said, here's what I would suggest you do before you do it. Take five kids and follow them for 24 hours for 4 days. And see if they only spend time in one social grouping. And if you can come back and tell me that indeed this is the way they live their lives 24 hours a day for 4 or 5 days in a row, I would stand up and I even be willing to be part of your story. At the end of it, they abandoned the story. I mean, part of what they have come to realize is that when you take a snapshot of a university and you see people congregating, it leads you to an impression. That's not the story if you have a moving picture and you watch people move in and out of zones of interactivity and interaction. It's also the case that part of the challenge in the United States is that we struggle to talk about race. And so the most difficult conversation in the U.S. remains the conversation about how to talk about race in the contemporary life. And you find that then coming back in other kinds of social policy. So the University of Michigan will prevail in the Grutter and Gratz case, and as a result, institutions across the United States were able to use race as one of several variables in the admissions process. The state of Michigan, however, there was a referendum, and a referendum called Prop 2, or the New Civil Rights Initiative, as it was called, sought to eliminate the use of race and gender as factors in college admission. Put to the voters, in the state of Michigan, some had assumed that the mothers and fathers would not do anything to harm their daughters, and so this was safe. Proved to be 58% of the voters of the state of Michigan voted for Prop 2. The idea that some would surrender their daughters if they could actually eliminate the idea that race would be a variable in admissions. Now, it's powerfully important for us as we talk about the contours of affirmative action to realize that in some ways what may result, and I'll jump to a final point and cut out some of the text here, but what we may actually find ourselves is actually in a very important moment. Because if the Fisher case ends up going the way that many of us believe, which is they're going to restrict down to it makes it almost impossible for us to use race as a variable in admissions process at selective universities and colleges. And I underscore here selective universities and colleges. Really, the debate over access in the United States is not about access to higher education. We still have more seats than there are students applying for those seats. And that's why we've been able to actually import enough international students over the last several generations to continue to populate our campuses. It's really about who gets to go to the most selective public and private institutions in the United States. And so if you realize that your likelihood of getting in is 10 to 1 or 15 to 1, that's when folks become interested. My late colleague Kermit Hall, who was at that point president of Utah State, wrote a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education in the United States saying, we have no problems with admissions at Utah State. Anyone who applies can get in. And Kermit was absolutely right. And so if we come back to then this question about in this post-racial America, post-Barack Obama's presidency of America, how do we think about what will happen? The real question, I think, for us to encounter is, what happens if the diversity argument fails? Will that force the U.S. into a much broader conversation about race? Do we actually go back to that chapter that was short and aborted between 1971 and 1978 to ask a different set of questions about how we create this diverse democracy? Do we then turn to other examples from around the world to ask questions about how you create a constitutional context for thinking not just about equality, but about equity? And what equity is the process by which you become equal. And I'm reminded of this. There was a story that Benjamin Hooks used to tell. And Ben Hooks, as some of you in this room know, at one point was the head of NAACP. And he'd grown up in Tennessee. And he used to tell a story. He says, what gets confusing in the American language system between equality and equity can be actually summarized in a foot race. And he says, if you look at a track, in the old days, according to Ben Hooks, everyone would line up in the same place and run the 440 because it looked like it was equal. Until someone actually did the measurements. And you came to realize that the person on the outside lanes, starting in the same place as the person on the inside lanes, actually was running a different distance. And if you began to look at then from the outside, that staggered lane process looked like it was unequal. But in some ways, you end up recognizing that there are structures and forms to every race that's run. And you create those staggered opportunities to make sure that you're not only achieving equality, but there's equity in the process. These are the questions that animate our time. They come in different forms, require the work of intellectuals and academics. They aren't answered in the same way by each community or each nation or in each time. But they remind us of the contours of the affirmative action debate. That it started out in a way as a response to years of segregation in the United States, a century, and slavery, 2.5 centuries. And that became a set of policies to respond to the immediacy of the end of that event, or those events or periods, only to be recognized that as we move forward, there had to be other kinds of ways of addressing then both equality, equity, and the building of a diverse democracy. Some would say at this particular point in time that in the U.S., that demography will take care of it all. By 2050, it is projected that the United States will be majority non-white. And we see trends. But if the goal of education is to not only create opportunity for encounter in the classroom, but a learning environment that enhances the likelihood that individuals will be active members of their communities and seek to raise the important questions and make the key discoveries, then we realize that in some ways it's not just enough to say demography will take care of it all. That we have to have social policies in place that continue to raise the specter that intentional human action requires structured opportunities for engagement. And in this period between now and 2050, the debate will continue to rage in the United States over what should be an effective affirmative action policy. And as we pause at this particular moment and hold our breath as the Supreme Court rules yet one more time, we're reminded that it is hard to conceive of a world in which we don't talk about the saliency of race. All the more so in this era of the human genome, where we can say with great precision that 0.1% of human variation is all we're talking about when we talk about that concept that we refer to as race. But that 0.1% has had a disproportionate weight in human history. In the 17th and 18th and 19th and 20th centuries, how do we think about and how do we talk about what language will we use to engage that 0.1% of human variation in the 21st century? And so I leave you with this observation. No matter what the next chapter, or let's say it differently, no matter how one thinks about the next chapter in American history and the contours of the affirmative action debate, the ways in which the U.S. shapes that conversation will have implications for the rest of the world. And it's important that as you sit here in South Africa, that you not only pay attention to the questions that are posed, that you offer your own answers. Because as we look ahead in the 21st century, it is a global community that will ultimately help shape the U.S. definition. More so in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years than it's ever been, I think, understood in my country. And so I wanted to set out a few points with a monologue that will hopefully lead to a dialogue and a conversation. Anyway, thank you. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for being here.
All right. So thank you very much, Dr. Lewis. So we have to watch the time quite carefully. Dr. Lewis has to leave here at 7 o'clock. Thank you, Steve. All right, so let's take a round of questions, comments. When you speak, please just say your name and...
And if you don't have questions, I'll have questions for you. So be forewarned. Yes.
Right. Let's go there. One, just before you speak, right? Who else would like to speak? Two at the back there. Behind you. Don't worry. I'm not a teacher. I don't run the class like that. Two. Anybody else want to go? Thank you. Another bit of... Right, so Victor,
please mind. Hello, sir. My name is Brian.
Hi.
I just wanted to pick your brain a bit about, you mentioned briefly about the segregation on campus.
Sure.
And how you dismissed the producers. What do you actually think about the way that students interact with each other on campus? Are you saying that there's no segregation?
No, in fact, I think there is segregation, but I actually think it is temporally bound segregation. And so what you end up... Years ago, I made use of a concept and redefined it called congregation. And so what you end up finding is that students will congregate in clusters of affinity groups that allows them for particular moments in time to assert, in some instance, a sense that they were either in control or the vectors of power were a little different. But it's, in my view, an incomplete picture to believe that most individuals on campus only live in those communities 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're moving in and out of classes, different kinds of study groups. I mean, so if you freeze, and the studies in the United States have been frozen, looking at where students congregate when they're sitting in the cafeteria for dinner or lunch. Beverly Tatum, who's the president of Spelman College, has written a classic book on and why do all the black kids eat together, sit together. And what Beverly has discovered is that, indeed, the lunchroom or cafeteria is one setting. The study hall is sometimes a different setting. The library is a different setting. Working on group projects is a different setting. And you actually need to actually, if you're going to talk about this, really think of the university not as just a frozen frame and a moving picture, but it's that moving picture. And that's really the point.
First, I just wanted to say thank you so much, Dr. Lewis, for coming to speak with us today. It was a wonderful speech. I'm actually from the great state of Michigan. But I've been living
what part?
In Traverse City.
Oh, yes. Spent time there.
Great. In the summer, I assume.
And the answer is yes.
But I've been living in South Africa for about the last 3 years. And okay. I actually worked briefly as an admission officer at a big American university. So I got a sort of inside look at how the admission process works from that perspective. And what I noticed is that there were a lot more qualified applicants than there were seats at
Absolutely.
The university, and which is also the case at a lot of schools here, such as the University of Cape Town. And so I came to stop thinking of this process as a pure meritocracy, meaning the most qualified students are admitted and the lesser qualified students are disregarded. And I started thinking about it as a process of creating a community.
Absolutely.
And we started to think about this as a question of what type of community do we want to create? And we value diversity in that community, so we prioritize that. My question to you is, why do people, in your opinion, have such a hard time accepting that version of college admission and instead insisting that it should be a straightforward competition between this person and the next person?
Thank you for your question. It is a very, very important question. Let me start with a disclaimer, which is in the last year I've actually joined the Board of Trustees of ETS, the Educational Testing Service. And so part of it is this notion that there has to be a way to discern who's qualified and who's not. And so if you go back to the University of Michigan cases and the Grutter and Graz cases, the University of Michigan argued that every student who was admitted was qualified. And so the real question was who among, or at least let me say it different, not admitted, but every student who they considered and considered for admission was qualified, and ultimately every student certainly was qualified. And so then the question becomes, should a university have the right to shape a class? And I think what many individuals struggle with is that there's somehow one or two variables that will determine who is more warranting of being able to sit in at various universities. And it's not, I mean, to your point, most of the students who are admitted certainly have the credentials. And then you're looking for those who have other things to add to round out a class. And when I was at the University of California, Berkeley, back in the 80s. At that point, the University of California had something called a special admissions program, and where it would allow us to find students who came from the rural parts of California, because we realized that was important to rounding out a class. At the University of Michigan, where the process is also trying to figure out students then from not only from Traverse City, but for those who know the geography of Michigan, the Iron Range, and it came from a small community. It wasn't always that they had the top score, but they had a range of scores that allowed them to be admissible to the university. I think we struggle with the fact that we believe that merit can be quantified, and there are ordinal rankings from one to whatever, and that you should only choose number one. And I know I have given instructions to admissions counselors over the last few years before moving to the Mellon Foundation. I said, look, what does it mean that we have a quote-unquote busy high school? This is the language system inside admissions operations, meaning that a lot of kids from a particular high school want to attend, in this case it was Emory University. And I had a admission director who said, there are 10 kids, and the guidance counselor has ranked them 1 to 10. And so we know how they rank according to the guidance counselors. And I have to take number 1, and I can never take number 10. And I would say, why? And they said, because the guidance counselor has already said that this kid is number 10 in this group, and that kid is number 1. I said, but how about if number 10 looks like he or she is a better fit? They all qualified, and we think about the one who actually will add the most to the community. That's the kind of conversation universities, certainly in the United States, don't actually share with the guidance counselors in the other communities. It's really the process by which a class is constructed and why you actually don't always want to take the number one kid, because the number one kid may have certain characteristics, but they don't actually complement the range of things you're trying to achieve in any given cohort. And for that, I think universities bear some responsibility. We haven't, to my satisfaction, demystified the admissions process, and we haven't always been straight and honest that the fact that you have a perfect score on your national exams and you have the top grade, that's very, very good. That's not the only thing that we should be looking at. And how do we look at the whole person? And that was part of what the courts have said in the last few years in the U.S. We should take a look at the entire person, the whole person. But thank you for your question. It's a very important one.
Hi. Hi. My name is Paul. I'm a postgrad student here. Well, thanks as well for the speech. I was very interested in coming here, and I discussed this with my brother, and he came up with a question, a comment,
okay,
which was actually not mentioned here, so I would like to throw it in the group. The whole idea about changing admission policies at a university, because the problem is certain minorities cannot get in through regular admission procedures, implies you have a problem with the academic level of those people. If you look at a career, a university career, it may last from, well, the education of somebody will last from age 4 or 5 till 20-something, perhaps. You are adjusting a process when people are at the final stage of their education. So you're actually changing a process when they enter the university level. Shouldn't you actually be talking about adjusting things when they're still in primary school or secondary school? Wouldn't it make much more sense to, and even more economical sense, to look at this problem when you can still more easily change things? So additional tutoring for people from minorities who are in that stage, in an initial stage in problems. Isn't that something that's logical and that's not sufficiently discussed?
Sure. Thank you for your question. And clearly the answer is that you need a systems approach, right? That K through 12, or in the U.S. being the analogy, primary and secondary education is very, very important. So most of the major foundations in the United States circa 15 years ago decided to focus on K through 12 education. The Gates Foundation, for instance, has a huge program there. But this goes and connect your question to the question that was previously asked. In the United States, and here I'll speak about the U.S. and leave it to others in the room here to talk about the details in South Africa, we have about 6,000 post-secondary institutions in the United States. And so there are a range of options for students to gain admission. And as I said earlier, it's not that in the main that we have a challenge with young people being able to find a college, a two-year or four-year institution to gain admission. The real intense debate over whether or not an individual is quote-unquote qualified really turns on admissions to the most selective institutions. And so the ones that have high name recognition, the Ivy League institutions like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Brown. But if you go and look at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Brown in the U.S., they have no problem finding kids who have the highest test scores. And so it's really not there. I mean, if you look, they're 1,400 on the old scale of 1,600. African-American kids and Latino kids who are scoring 14 and 1,500. So it's not really a question about who's qualified, but it is a question about how you actually rank them, because they're all within the boundaries of likely success. And so there's a book by one of my predecessors, former president of the Mellon Foundation, Bill Bowen. And Bill has looked at kids from a select number of colleges and universities, how they prevailed while in school and what happened to them several years out. And you find then that kids who go to these most selective institutions tend to graduate on average much higher than kids who go to the non-selective colleges and schools. Part of it is the built-in environment. And so not only do they graduate at a higher level, they end up tending to be in professions later on that are at the top end of the socioeconomic spectrum in the United States. And so I actually think, at least in the U.S. case, it overstates the matter to say that the primary problem is that we've somehow admitted unqualified students. That doesn't happen, really. And all the data would show that the students who gain admissions to the most selective institutions are highly qualified. It's just that there's a range. They don't all have the same profile. And the real challenge is when you have 10 applicants for one seat, how do you, and I'm going to say this in most neutral ways, but how do you effectively discriminate? Because you really have a whole range of choices. It's not that you're engaging in discriminatory behavior. It's that you have to figure out then what you want an individual class to look like. And do you want it all from one community or another community? And so, I mean, others here can speak to the South African example more, but I think we've actually moved beyond that question in the United States, so much so that I'll add a historical footnote, that the opponents of affirmative action, when it went to the Supreme Court in the Michigan example, did not debate whether the students were qualified. They agreed that the black students who were being admitted to the University of Michigan were qualified. It's actually in the record. I mean, they just didn't like the idea that race should be a variable. I mean, they were very explicit. Said, no, the students are qualified. We just don't think you should take into account their racial background. And so it's a different moment, at least in the evolution of the public policy and social policy debate in the United States. And my retort to those who were in that case, isn't it odd to imagine that the only time race won't be noticed is when a young person is being admitted to college? It's noted everywhere else from the moment you're born, because in many places in the United States it's still noting on your birth certificate. And is noted sometimes on public documents like your driver's license. It's noted in certain parts of the U.S. even on your death certificate. And so birth, during young adulthood, and death, but not when you're seeking admissions to college. Seems odd in a certain kind of way. And so that's the moment of conversation and debate as we try to figure out why access to this particular domain is so different. And what is it about power that makes people more fearful of that particular sector and that particular moment in life than any other moment in life? I mean, it's an open question that we'll have to keep considering.
Okay, I'm going to take three more questions. One, two, three.
Well, and you can take them all at once, and I'll just fold them all into one answer.
It's okay. Quickly then, Rocky. Sorry,
Thanks. Rod Solomons, talking in my capacity as from UCT Black Alumni Association.
Mm.
You spoke, the issues are around admission and selection, etc. Yeah. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts around once these kids, and especially black kids in South Africa, are selected to come to university. Your thoughts around support programs, your thoughts about support programs to assist them to deal with them being at university.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Thank you. Hi, thank you. And one of the divisive factors, even in a diverse setting, is the socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
So we have students here who come from the remotest areas and with a disadvantaged schooling. And we're mixing them in a resident system. I come from the resident system. We're mixing them with students who come from the plush suburbs of the big cities and, you know, private school, that kind of city. Now, they come here with their own interests, and it's a huge obstacle to overcome. I mean, we try culture evenings. We try all sorts of things to get them to interact. There are some of us who believe we shouldn't be doing anything. We should just let them spontaneously get together. I think there's some merit in that argument, but I'm not going to argue that here. But these are a huge obstacle we have to overcome, because students tell us directly to our faces, well, I come from Johannesburg, you know, I mean, I have different interests. Why you want me to sit at that particular table at dinner?
Mm-hmm.
You're not my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis. Zola is my name. Just two questions. I hope I heard you correctly when you said social policies would be the way to go in addressing the issues we are dealing with. If that's the case, we need people with the right heart, right mind, commitment. We need monitoring. We also need sanctions,
mm-hmm.
You know, to make sure then the policies become a reality. And finally, there's an issue of economics, because you cannot enforce those rights, you know, that would be enshrined in that policy if you don't have the financial resources, because legal costs in this country are exorbitant, and poor people find it difficult then, you know, to challenge that. Secondly, would you also say there is a correlation between the reversal of the gains that have been made in higher education, but also in other spheres of life, with who sits on the bench, be it in the Supreme Court or in any other court? Thank you.
Okay, last question was in this area here. Has it disappeared? This one. Oh, it was in Scott.
Thank you. Ian Scott from this university. Just to say, I want to strongly endorse your point about what is defined as merit is absolutely crucial in our circumstances. It's a big topic. Just 2 points. By and large, South African higher education selects students on the basis of one set of examinations, the school leaving examinations. And that is regarded in many people's minds as absolutely the indicator of merit.
Mm.
So in disputes, you will hear this student got 3 C's and a D, and this one got 2 C's and 2 D's. There's no argument about the merit.
Yeah.
In my mind, that does not make sense for 2 important reasons. First, the instrument itself is not necessarily designed, we know it isn't, to predict how well somebody is going to do or benefit from higher education. That to me is the important word, benefit from, and the community to benefit from. It's not an SAT.
Yeah.
And that's controversial enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The second thing is, in our view, and I come from an area where we have provided student support, what we see with people is a trajectory. They are moving, they are dynamic, they are changing. So that school leaving exam comes at a moment.
Yeah.
You take a snapshot, and there is no indication of the trajectory, how far different people have come, which way they are going. So on both counts, and we see people changing dramatically over short periods when they are given an opportunity. So on both counts, it's a highly suspect model for determining merit. I'm saying it now to get a comment from you, particularly with your SAT hat on,
sure,
but also to say that I think this university needs to take that debate forward very powerfully. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me see if I can answer the range of questions, and thank you all for each of your questions. Clearly, when you think about what it means to be on a college campus and you're bringing young people in, and you're recognizing that they have different socioeconomic backgrounds, they've had different access, or in some cases differential access, to the various elements that will predict success in an environment like a selective university. And so in that case, then, I think it's important for us to always create programs that are going to ensure the success of our students. And so the U.S., I'll give a concrete example. In the 1990s, a number of universities in the United States created something called the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program. It was designed to actually help first-generation, low-income, mostly minority kids, to get a foothold in the university, because some research has shown that kids who actually engage in research in their first year tend to have a better success record. And what we discovered was, and was interesting, what we discovered was is that that was indeed the case at the University of Michigan, and we tested it over time. But it was also the case that we realized this is a program then that could benefit all students. And so a set of experiments that began with first-generation students of color became a program that then was extended to the entire student population. And I use this example to talk about, so if you create programs for one group of students, you may find there are outcomes that are beneficial for all students. And so institutions will have to continue to experiment and raise the question, what's our commitment to the students? It's always been my view that once you've admitted the student, you've already decided that he or she has a probability of success. And then the institution has to structure itself to enhance that probability. And that the old notion of looking to your left and looking to your right and telling a group of kids on the first day that one of you won't be here, hopefully is no longer part of the ways in which we organize learning. I mean, because in some ways, if you thought that kid shouldn't be there, you should have actually invited them to come. I mean, in the first place. I mean, that really is my perspective. It's not that time that you're actually trying to get rid of students. It's really that time when you're trying to figure out how to develop students. I mean, socioeconomic differences certainly prevail. But we were having a conversation earlier today about online learning, and particularly the massively open online courses and MOOCs, and the ways in which online learning will transform higher education both here in South Africa and around the world. And we realize that more and more students will come into an environment where there may be differences in preparation and background upon arrival. But, and this goes to the socioeconomic, there is something, in fact, important about the socialization process of 18 to 22 to 25-year-old period, where you're actually meeting people for the first time. And so it's not just the low-income student who is struggling and looking at his or her classmate who has come from a community of wealth. But my guess is if UCT is anything like the universities in the United States I'm familiar with, many of the upper-income students have never actually had to share space in their lives. I mean, the first time they actually realize that they have to actually deal with another person in a small room is when they come to college. And a new set of learnings and socialization that comes as a result of that kind of proximity. And when you ask different questions and you have different experiences. So there will be friction as people are discovering new ways of interacting. Should some of that friction be organized? Probably. Should some of that friction just occur naturally? It has to. It is 18 and you're sitting in a dorm room and you're up until 2 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out how the rest of your life will take shape. That is part of the learning process. But as we know, that there are institutions that play an important role. And so in the U.S., clearly the courts have played a predominant role in shaping our social policy. I was sitting with the former dean of the law school at Stanford 2 weeks ago out in Seattle, and he kept saying to me, this is the former dean of the law school at Stanford, mind you, says, I don't know why people pay so much attention to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said this to me two or three times, and by the third time he really had my attention. I go, what do you mean? And he says, there are ways in which the courts have shaped social policy without fully understanding it. And what's been the most remarkable part about American democracy is the ways in which individual citizens allow them to say it without challenging them in some profound way. It may be that in the near future, at least in the U.S. context, people will begin to challenge fundamentals of understanding when and how effective social policy improves the democratic outcomes in the U.S. But we have to shape those conversations. I mean, after all, our U.S. Congress is now pulling money away from the study of political science because they don't want to actually know how people vote. This is serious. I'm not making this up. And President Obama actually acquiesced because he needed a particular bill passed, and so he acquiesced. And they withdrew money from the National Science Foundation for political behavior research. I mean, these are real questions when you have then various branches of government acting in ways that seem detrimental to the whole notion and power of a democratic society. And then the last piece, and I'll conclude with this and with a thank you. The last part of it is that when we look at and think about institutions, a healthy institution is one that is willing to interrogate itself. And sometimes the most difficult things to deal with are those questions that are most pregnant with a whole range of possibilities. But I would hope that the University of Cape Town would always continue to be what I've experienced to be a living institution made up of individuals who are prepared to step back and say, what program should we create for black kids? What things should we do to ensure that social economic behavior is taken into consideration both at the admission stage and upon arrival on campus? How do we make sure that we hold our leaders responsible for their actions and their words? And how do we continue to believe that the process of improving and creating a diverse democracy is a never-ending process? That is not an event. It's a process. And indeed, we have not perfected that process yet. Thank you.
Great thanks to Dr. Lewis for having spent the better part of an hour and a half here with us, and our real appreciation for you sharing this experience and your insight and taking this very important engagement with the audience. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.